My father homesteaded it. We would be part of the hay crew.
That's Eleanor Rogers talking about her childhood memories.
Feed the chickens, pluck the chickens when we had fried chicken.
Almost everyone from a rural place in Wyoming or other rural parts of America can identify with what she's talking about. However, in this next part of her oral history, she throws a curveball.
We had one that was a Nazi.
What?
And he was what you would imagine. He was very tall, very straight, blonde hair that was crew cut. Very military. I was a little afraid of him.
So at what point did this woman, who was just a child plucking chickens and doing ranch stuff in Douglas, Wyoming, come into contact with a Nazi?
You don't hear anything about it as far as open discussion. Talking about the prisoner of war camp, you don't hear anything about it.
That was 180 building camp built on 687 acres in 90 days. You never hear about it.
In 1943, this tiny town on Wyoming's eastern prairies would house over double its own population in German and Italian combatants, and then, just a couple years later, would lose almost all of it.
They were afraid that someone will get loose and escape and all that.
On this episode of That Doesn't Happen Every Day, in which we interview everyday people about things that don't normally happen every day, we look at the unusual relationships between people whose families were fighting a war overseas and how they treated prisoners from some of those countries right here in Wyoming.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
We all listened to the radio, and when FDR declared war, I remember that instant.
When World War II started, Douglas, Wyoming had a little over 2,000 people. It was built mostly on farming and ranching. And in fact, even today when you ask one of this small town's residents about what their life is like, these are the kind of things they'll tell you.
And I still ride a horse.
Up at the ranch.
At the ranch.
Like a lot of other places in the cowboy state, they're very close to and proud of their history. And they can tell you a lot of stories from it.
I did find an Indian head penny where the old schoolhouse used to be.
Here's Robert Weiss talking about what he remembers happening just before the army arrived in Douglas to set up high fences and watchtowers across the river from town.
And I had a friend that was right across the street from me that was a year older. He got killed on Omaha Beach.
The army was building a place to hold the kind of people the locals had seen on newsreels at their tiny theater. The kind of people in dark uniforms that stood at attention at huge rallies shouting Sieg Heil and shooting their arms straight up into a Nazi salute. The kind of people who'd shot and bombed and bayoneted people like Robert Wise's neighbor.
Douglas Enterprise. Lyle Dedmore, former Douglas boy, visited Douglas Saturday. He moved about on crutches, having lost his right foot on the battlefront in Germany.
You're hearing the voice of Hayward Schrock, by the way, who is kind enough to read local news reports from the time.
You know, these were families whose sons and fathers and brothers were all fighting this war.
That's Sherry Molinix, who spent a ton of time researching the camp. Bill Lehman, who you heard from earlier about how he still rides his horse, describes the scene of the first prisoners arriving in Douglas when he was so little that he was only
knee-high to grasshopper. There was some snow falling that night, and it was dark, and they unloaded the prisoners on this side of the river. And that impressed me because the way they were marching, I thought, my golly, what's this?
Italians would come in off of the train, and they had to walk quite a ways across the big bridge.
That's Dorothy Petronovich, who lived close enough to see the prisoners from her house when they arrived.
And they just would sing Italian songs all the time. And Pete and I could hear them singing.
Douglas Enterprise, 17th August 1943. The first group of prisoners from the Douglas Prisoner of War Camp, numbering 412 Italians, arrived here. Of the 412 internees, 10 were immediately hospitalized, some suffering from wounds and other from several different maladies.
There's one story about the first batch of Italian prisoners that came in and they were being marched from the train depot, and someone in the crowd yelled out, "Do you know where you are?" And one of the Italian prisoners yelled back, yes, were where Tom Mix lives.
Tom Mix was a famous movie cowboy, and it's likely that the landscape of Wyoming reminded this newly arrived Italian POW of the westerns he'd probably seen in theaters back in his own town. Joe Shinmori talks about what most Douglas residents saw of the camp as the prisoners settled in.
The old POW camp, they had a fence all around, a lot of barracks, and then guard towers.
When you could drive up and down that road, much of the time the prisoners would be out doing whatever.
The camp had everything from long, low barracks with bunk beds to a sanitation plant, to a hospital and canteen. You can see pictures of POWs hanging out in the canteen with dungaree-like uniforms with the letters P and W on the butt of the pants.
Douglas Enterprise. The prisoners have radios donated by welfare agencies and receive newspapers. Soccer is the favorite sport. Intercompany games are scheduled Sunday afternoons by the special services officer. They're allowed to take hikes around the countryside accompanied by guards, visit one another in different compounds, and American relatives can visit them at the stockade.
It's understandable that anybody would ask, why are these people who've killed many Americans being treated so well?
Douglas Enterprise. While it is true that prisoners are enemies of this country, and many have been directly responsible for the loss of American lives, they cannot be treated entirely as enemies, but must be treated as soldiers rather than as criminals. Always with this thought in the background, the treatment we accord enemy captives will, in some measure at least, determine the kind of treatment given to American soldiers who have been unfortunate enough to fall into enemy hands.
Robert Weiss, the man whose neighbor was killed on D-Day, had a job that included delivering fuel to the camp as a teenager. An experience he had there gave an important insight into the difference between a POW and a criminal.
They had a trustee there, and he was a German, and he was about 2 years older than I was at that time. He was probably 19 or 20, and he could speak English fairly well, and this German would get in the cab with me, and he'd show me where to go and help me hook up my hoses and put the gas where it was supposed to be, and we'd sit there and talk. In the beginning, he would just say, well, I just want this war to get over and so I can go home. We did this for several weeks all summer. And other than his accent, he was just like you and me talking. We were, you might say, friends from day one. He was not political. I wasn't political. He was a good German. I was a good American. And we both respected that.
It should be noted that even though Robert was later inducted into military service to go fight people, just like the friend he'd made at the camp, even years later, he doesn't seem to hold it against him. He points out how the different compounds in the camp reflected the different degrees of commitment to the Reich that prisoners might have had, just as the people of Douglas were starting to see that not all of the men on the other side of the fence were the same.
They had the true Nazis in a different place than they had these just regular guys. Like they had, say, a compound for the Nazis and a compound for the not-so-Nazis.
Bud Turner was serving as a fighter pilot during the war and also got access to the camp when he was home on leave. He had an experience there with one of the Nazis who was not a not-so-Nazi, but a very Nazi.
I got a call from the prisoner war camp, and he said they had a German pilot out there if I'd like to come out and talk to him. So I went out there. Of course, he couldn't talk English. I couldn't talk German, so we had an interpreter, but he was a very arrogant fellow. He was just very aloof. He was just a little bit better than everybody else. And this was in probably about, I think, March or April of 44. He still thought he was going to win the war.
Sometime after Bud had talked to this German officer who insisted that Germany was going to win the war, Bud was training some fighter pilots based in Colorado, and on their flight back from Casper, Wyoming, they flew in a very tight formation right towards his hometown of Douglas.
Well, I come right over the prisoner of war camp, pretty darn low, about twice high as this building. And boy, they called it in. I didn't know you couldn't fly over one. I didn't even realize I was over it. So the colonel called me in, but he said, that didn't hurt anything and didn't make anything of it, so I didn't get in any trouble.
Military government American style.
One measure at Camp Douglas to combat the effects of fascism was to teach POWs about the American system of government. In one experiment, each barrack represented a fictional county, each compound a state, and the entire camp represented a country. All went well until the German president of the camp became something of a dictator himself and had to be impeached. A news article from the time mentioned how when guards caught hardened POWs committed to the fascist cause, abusing or tormenting their fellow prisoners, they were quickly isolated from the rest of the group. This might be the separation of the Nazis from the not-so-Nazis spoken of earlier. One of the camp's own newspapers, run by the Germans called the Eckhart, was called out by authorities as rabid Nazi propaganda and was shut down after only two issues. Eventually, it was replaced by the more moderate Douglas Offenwart, the Douglas Open Word.
A guard comes out there with a jeep. There's three prisoners. And he dropped them off and he took off.
That's Bill Lehman again, talking about the time he saw a military jeep arrive on his family's property.
This guard did with a weapon, and he was dropping them off at different places up here to help put up hay. That was their thing, to help put up hay.
The ranchers, their sons and fathers were in the war, so they needed help to do this heavy farming and ranching business.
That's Adeline Schulice.
They didn't speak a word of English, but they did all right though, after they got knew what was going on. They did all right.
They were paid 35 cents per hour by the ranchers, and they were paid $4 a day by the government.
We had a bunkhouse, and they would go to the bunkhouse and eat lunch. And my mother was a great cook. She would fry chicken, and my job was to go down and take the chicken to the prisoners. The fact that they would send a 10-year-old down to the bunkhouse by herself, they trusted them.
Eleanor's husband, Jess, points out something about her father and her brother in light of her being sent to give food to the POWs at the bunkhouse.
Her dad was a doughboy in World War I, so he had been at war with these people, plus his son, as we said, was in the Air Force. And you see, there was not any animosity that I ever really heard.
My 10-year-old mind didn't associate these prisoners being killers. I remember one was Italian, but on the most part, they were German.
Do you remember their names?
Adolf was one. The one guy I was especially fond of him, he was 40 years old, but his whole family was dead. They were all killed in Germany. He gave me a Bible, and I took it to show and tell at school. They enlisted everybody they could get. They didn't want to be fighting this war.
Well, talking about how well POWs at Camp Douglas were treated, there's a part of this story that I think is really important to hear. Here's Joseph Shinmori.
When the war was going on, I think we were about the only Japanese people around here. We were restricted from traveling no more than 25-mile radius of Douglas.
I'm thankful to say that neither Joseph nor his family were sent to Heart Mountain internment camp over in Cody, Wyoming, or any of the other camps where American citizens of Japanese ancestry were sent. But his family did have some of their property confiscated.
The sheriff came and collected all our rifles, 22 and shotgun, I remember, and shortwave radio. And any knife over 10 inches long, cameras, binoculars.
Ironically, Joseph served in the U.S. Army. He was shot in the leg in Italy while pulling another soldier to safety.
Luckily, it didn't hit my bone, so.
He still has some back problems now because of his wound. After completing his service and returning to the U.S., he went to get his family's things.
So I went to the sheriff's office, and they had no record.
This honestly is probably one of the parts of the story that bothers me the most. That his people in Douglas were doing their best to treat POWs right. This American citizen, who was wounded in combat to fight oppression, had his family's things lost. That doesn't happen every day is not meant to attack or be hypercritical of the U.S. or the past or anything like that, but I did want to make sure that this part was included.
Douglas Enterprise. The three German prisoners who escaped from the Douglas clamp last week were captured last Thursday afternoon along the banks of the Platte River near the Fritz Schneider place. Sheriff Eivester said the Germans were resting and had planned to travel that night when they would not be seen.
I heard the story that they were amazed how big this country is, how far you can go without it.
I couldn't find any other records of escapes from the camp, and I couldn't even find any records of very many people dying in the camp, though there were a few. When the war ended, the prisoners were sent back to where they were from.
When they went, they were boys. And when they came home 10 years later, they were men, and they came home to a country that was ruined. They came home to families that, if they were still alive, were living in destitute conditions. They were starving to death. There was no food. There was no material to rebuild homes.
Some of them came back from Germany after the war. They became friends with some of the ranchers.
And one of them, he wanted to come back, so Walt Busch kind of sponsored him. He came back and worked for Walt a few years, made enough money, so he bought a place.
Mr. Alchemist, here this guy shows up with his family, and Sandy Cross says, "Oh, good, I'm glad to see you." So he moved in, and he immediately started working for Sandy Cross. And his son is still alive, and his name is Rolf. Rolf Alchemist, and he lives in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Rolf Algermissen, not Alchemist, went on to serve in the U.S. Army in Vietnam and retired after 21 years of service. The Germans who returned to Douglas, Wyoming, saw the old barracks and other buildings from the POW camp removed and repurposed as everything from animal sheds to a hangar for a small airplane. The camp's hospital was kept where it was and used as a civilian hospital for everyone in Douglas for many years. Today, the old officers' club is all that remains of Camp Douglas. Its walls are covered with paintings of the Old West made by prisoners, inspired by the works of Western artists like Charlie Russell and Frederick Remington. Sherry Mullinix has pushed hard for the building to be preserved and shared.
But there is something sweet about that building.
I thought it was weird that she'd call the last remaining building in a camp where people were forced to stay for years sweet, but what she adds makes sense to me.
In this horrific war, we treated these men decently. Despite how our people were being treated that were prisoners, we treated them according to the Geneva Convention. And from a military standpoint and from a civilian standpoint, we recognized that they were fellow human beings and related to one another in that fashion. One prisoner wrote, this line will stay with me forever, that when I was a prisoner in your country was the only time in my life I felt like a free man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of That Doesn't Happen Every Day. I would like to thank everybody who appeared on this episode, and I also want to make sure to thank Mark Youngie, who recorded these oral histories and has done a lot to try to preserve and share Wyoming's history. If you would like to visit the Officers Club that was part of Camp Douglas, please check the link in the description for dates and times when you can arrange a visit. If you'd like to hear more episodes of That Doesn't Happen Every Day, search for That Doesn't Happen Every Day podcast. Remember that every day is two words in this case. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope to have a new episode to you soon.